Chapter 14. Flat. It was a hateful idea that her tender cheek should be kissed by the lips of this heavy young man, who had never been sublimed by a single battle, even with defenseless savages. The soldier went before her house, looked at the door, and moved on down the crooked way to the cliffs, where there was a path back to the forts. But he did not adopt it, returning by the way he had come. This showed his wish to pass the house again. She gave no sign, however, and the soldier disappeared. Pearson could not be satisfied that a vice was in the house, and he crossed over to the front of her little freehold and tapped at the door, which stood ajar. Nobody came. Hearing a slight movement within, he crossed the threshold. A vice was there alone, sitting on a low stool in a dark corner, as though she wished to be unobserved by any casual passerby. She looked up at him without emotion or apparent surprise, but he could then see that she was crying. The view, for the first time, of distress in an unprotected young girl towards whom he felt drawn by ties of extraordinary delicacy and tenderness, moved Pearson beyond measure. He entered without ceremony. "A vice, my dear girl." he said. "Something is the matter." She looked assent, and he went on. "Now tell me all about it. Perhaps I can help you. Come, tell me."
"I can't."
She murmured. "Grammar Stockwell is upstairs, and she'll hear." Mrs. Stockwell was the old woman who had come to live with the girl for company since her mother's death. "Then come into my garden opposite. There we shall be quite private." She rose, put on her hat, and accompanied him to the door. Here she asked him if the lane were empty, and on his assuring her that it was, she crossed over and entered with him through the garden wall. The place was a shady and secluded one, though through the boughs the sea could be seen quite near at hand, its moanings being distinctly audible. A water drop from a tree fell here and there, but the rain was not enough to hurt them. "Now let me hear it," he said soothingly. "You may tell me with the greatest freedom. I was a friend of your mother's, you know. That is, I knew her, and I'll be a friend of yours." The statement was risky if he wished her not to suspect him of being her mother's false one. But that lover's name appeared to be unknown to the present device. "I can't tell you, sir," she replied unwillingly, "except that it has to do with my own changeableness. The rest is the secret of somebody else."
"I am sorry for that," said he. "I am getting to care for one I ought not to think of, and it means ruin. I ought to get away."
"You mean from the island?"
"Yes."
Pearson reflected. His presence in London had been desired for some time, yet he had delayed going because of his new solicitudes here. But to go and take her with him would afford him opportunity of watching over her, tending her mind, and developing it, while it might remove her from some looming danger. It was a somewhat awkward guardianship for him, as a lonely man, to carry out. Still, it could be done. He asked her abruptly if she would really like to go away for a while.
"I like best to stay here," she answered. "Still, I should not mind going somewhere, because I think I ought to."
"Would you like London?"
A vice's face lost its sweeping shape.
"How could that be?"
she said. "I have been thinking that you could come to my house and make yourself useful in some way. I rent just now one of those new places called flats, which you may have heard of, and I have a studio at the back."
"I haven't heard of them," she said without interest.
"Well, I have two servants there, and as my man has a holiday, you can help them for a month or two."
"Would polishing furniture be any good?"
"I can do that."
"I haven't much furniture that requires polishing."
but you can clear away plaster and clay messes in the studio, and chippings of stone, and help me in modeling, and dust all my Venus failures, and hands and heads and feet and bones, and other objects. She was startled, yet attracted by the novelty of the proposal. Only for a time? She said. Only for a time. As short as you like, and as long. The deliberate manner in which, after the first surprise, a vice discussed the arrangements that he suggested, might have told him, how far was any feeling for himself beyond friendship, and possibly gratitude, from agitating her breast. Yet there was nothing extravagant in the discrepancy between their ages, and he hoped, after shaping her to himself, to win her. What had grieved her to tears she would not more particularly tell. As he had naturally not much need of preparation, but she made even less preparation than he would have expected her to require. She seemed eager to be off immediately, and not a soul was to know of her departure. Why, if she were in love, and at first averse to leave the island, she should be so precipitate now he failed to understand. But he took great care to compromise in no way a girl in whom his interest was as protective as it was passionate. He accordingly left her to get out of the island alone, awaiting her at a station a few miles up the railway, where, discovering himself to her through the carriage window, he entered the next compartment, his frame pervaded by a glow which was almost joy at having for the first time in his charge one who inherited the flesh, and bore the name so early associated with his own, and at the prospect of putting things right which had been wrong through many years. 2. 11. The image persists. It was dark when the four-wheeled cab wherein he had brought a vice from the station stood at the entrance to the pile of flats, of which Pearson occupied one floor rarer than as residences in London than they are now. Leaving a vice to alight and get the luggage taken in by the porter, Pearson went upstairs. To his surprise, his floor was silent, and on entering with a latchkey the rooms were all in darkness. He descended to the hall, where a vice was standing helpless beside the luggage, while the porter was outside with the cabman. Do you know what has become of my servants? Asked Jocelyn. What, and ain't they there, sore? Ah, then my belief is that what I suspected is true. You didn't leave your wine cellar unlocked, did you, sore, by no mistake? Pearson considered. He thought he might have left the key with his elder servant, whom he had believed he could trust, especially as the cellar was not well stocked. Ah, then it was so. She's been very queer, sore, this last week or two. Oh yes, sending messages down the spaken tube which were like madness itself, and ordering us this and that, till we would take no notice at all. I see them both go out last night, and possibly they went for a holiday not expecting ye, or maybe for good. Sure, if he had written, sore, I'd ha' got the place ready, ye being out of a man to, though it's not me duty at all. When Pearson got to his floor again he found that the cellar door was open. Some bottles were standing empty, that had been full, and many abstracted altogether. All other articles in the house, however, appeared to be intact. His letter to his housekeeper lay in the box as the postman had left it. By this time the luggage had been sent up in the lift, and a vice, like so much more luggage, stood at the door, the hall porter behind offering his assistance. Come here, a vice, said the sculptor. What shall we do now? Here's a pretty state of affairs. A vice could suggest nothing, till she was struck with the bright thought that she should light a fire. Light a fire? Ah, yes. I wonder if we could manage. This is an odd coincidence and awkward. He murmured. Very well, light a fire. Is this the kitchen, sir, all mixed up with the parlors? Yes. Then I think I can do all that's wanted here for a bit, at any rate, till you can get help, sir. At least, I could if I could find the fuel house. 'Tis no such big place as I thought. Apostrophe, that's right. Take courage. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said he with a tender smile. Now, I'll dine out this evening, and leave the place for you to arrange as best you can with the help of the porter's wife downstairs. Apostrophe, apostrophe, this Pearson accordingly did, and so their common residence began. Feeling more and more strongly that some danger awaited her in her native island, he determined not to send her back till the lover, or lovers who seemed to trouble her, should have cooled off. He was quite willing to take the risk of his action thus far in his solicitous regard for her. It was a dual solitude, indeed. For, though Pearson and Device were the only two people in the flat, they did not keep each other company, the former being as scrupulously fearful of going near her now that he had the opportunity as he had been prompt to seek her when he had none. They lived in silence, his messages to her being frequently written on scraps of paper deposited, where she could see them. It was not without a pang that he noted her unconsciousness of their isolated position, a position to which, had she experienced any reciprocity of sentiment, she would readily have been alive. Considering that, though not profound, she was hardly a matter-of-fact girl as that phrase is commonly understood, she was exasperating in the matter-of-fact quality of her responses to the friendly remarks which would escape him in spite of himself, as well as in her general conduct. Whenever he formed some culinary excuse for walking across the few yards of tessellated hall which separated his room from the kitchen, and spoke through the doorway to her, she answered, "Yes, sir," apostrophe or "no, sir," without turning her eyes from the particular work that she was engaged in. In the usual course he would have obtained a couple of properly qualified servants immediately. But he lived on with the one, or rather the less than one, that this cottage girl afforded. It had been his almost invariable custom to dine at one of his clubs. Now he sat at home over the miserable chopper steak to which he limited himself in dread lest she should complain of there being too much work for one person, and demand to be sent home. A charwoman came every two or three days, effecting an extraordinary consumption of food and alcoholic liquids. Yet it was not for this that Pearson dreaded her presence, but lest, in conversing with a vice, she should open the girl's eyes to the oddity of her situation. A vice could see for herself that there must have been two or three servants in the flat during his former residence there. But his reasons for doing without them seemed never to strike her. His intention had been to keep her occupied exclusively at the studio, but accident had modified this. However, he sent her round one morning, and entering himself shortly after found her engaged in wiping the layers of dust from the casts and models. The color of the dust never ceased to amaze her. "It is like the hold of a budmouth collier," apostrophe she said, "and the beautiful faces of these clay people are quite spoilt by it." Apostrophe, apostrophe, "I suppose you'll marry someday, a vice?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, remarked Pearson, as he regarded her thoughtfully. "Some do and some don't," apostrophe she said, with a reserved smile, still attending to the casts. "Apostrophe, apostrophe, you are very offhand," apostrophe said he. She archly weighed that remark without further speech. It was tantalizing conduct in the face of his instinct to cherish her, especially when he regarded the charm of her bending profile, the well-characterized, though softly lined nose, the round chin with, as it were, a second leap in its curve to the throat, and the sweep of the eyelashes over the rosy cheek during the sedulously lowered glance. How futilely he had labored to express the character of that face in clay, and, while catching it in substance, had yet lost something that was essential. That evening after dusk, in the stress of writing letters, he sent her out for stamps. As he had been absent some quarter of an hour when, suddenly drawing himself up from over his writing table, it flashed upon him that he had absolutely forgotten her total ignorance of London. The head post office, to which he had sent her, because it was late, was two or three streets off, and he had made his request in the most general manner, which as he had acceded to with alacrity enough. How could he have done such an unreflecting thing? Pearson went to the window. It was 9:30, and owing to her absence the blinds were not down. He opened the casement and stepped out upon the balcony. The green shade of his lamp screened its rays from the gloom without. Over the opposite square the moon hung, and to the right there stretched a long street, filled with a diminishing array of lamps, some single, some in clusters, among them an occasional blue or red one. From a corner came the notes of a piano organ strumming out a stirring march of Rossini's. The shadowy black figures of pedestrians moved up, down, and across the embrined roadway. Above the roofs was a bank of livid mist, and higher a greenish-blue sky, in which stars were visible, though its lower part was still pale with daylight, against which rose chimney pots in the form of elbows, prongs, and fists. From the whole scene proceeded a ground rumble, miles in extent, upon which individual rattles, voices, a tin whistle, the bark of a dog, rode like bubbles on a sea. The whole noise impressed him with the sense that no one in its enormous mass ever required rest. In this illimitable ocean of humanity there was a unit of existence, his a vice, wandering alone. Pearson looked at his watch. As he had been gone 30 minutes, it was impossible to distinguish her at this distance, even if she approached. He came inside, and putting on his hat determined to go out and seek her. He reached the end of the street, and there was nothing of her to be seen. As he had the option of 2 or 3 routes from this point to the post office, yet he plunged at random into one, till he reached the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.